Hello listeners, it is Editor Matt here. Just a quick note before we start this episode to say that this Saturday, the 3rd of December, we are having our first ever About Buildings and Cities social. We will be at the King's Arms pub in Bethnal Green in London from 5 p.m. till late. So if you're in London and you're free and you'd like to come hang out with other fans of the podcast, we invite you to come join us. Without any further ado, I hope you enjoy this episode of the show. Thanks a lot for listening.
At 3:30 a.m. on the night of June the 5th, 1992, the top telepath in the Sol system fell off the map in the offices of Runciter Associates in New York City. That started vidphones ringing. The Runciter organisation had lost track of too many of Hollis's sighs during the last 2 months. This added disappearance wouldn't do. Mr. Runciter, sorry to bother you. The technician in charge of the night shift at the map room coughed nervously as the massive, sloppy head of Glenn Runciter swam up to fill the vid screen. Runciter said, "I'll call my dead wife."
Cool.
Yeah. So that is the opening of Philip K. Dick's Ubik, which is a science fiction novel which doesn't actually have very much to do with architecture, it turns out. Some of the topics previously encountered in the kind of extended About Buildings and Cities canon do occasionally hove into view. So yeah, you're listening to About Buildings and Cities. I'm Luke Jones.
I'm George Gingell.
And I'm Matt Roberts.
Yeah, we've got Matt with us today to provide the invaluable Gen Z perspective on gnosticism, epistemological paranoia, amphetamines, all that kind of thing. So, I mean, Philip K. Dick is, there's a science fiction writing award named after him. He's one of the most famous sci-fi writers of the mid-20th century. His work has been adapted for film many, many times. He's very well known. If you've never heard of him before, I do heartily recommend his books. And Ubik, I think, is one of the, is probably one of the most famous as a work of literature. Mm-hmm. I think some of the others are more famous because of film adaptations and kind of other media that they've kind of led to.
Yeah.
Like, Total Recall.
Yeah, Total Recall.
Total Recall. Minority Report as well, based on a Dick novel.
Yeah, Blade Runner.
Total Recall is just the coolest, that's all.
Yeah. He started writing in the early 50s. He died in 82. He had like a very, very compressed and extremely productive writing career lasting about 30 years, during which he wrote, I think, 44 or 45 novels and more than 100 short stories.
Most of them before, between perhaps 1953 and 1970.
Yeah. I'd say that like the last decade, he really slowed down as well. So it was really...
Two novels and 10 short stories a year, something like that.
Yeah. He has like a slightly kind of ambivalent relationship to genre. He's like very much a science fiction writer. Some of the stuff he does is extremely tropey, but he's also, I think, like constantly trying to move away from it in certain ways. Or he's kind of has a sort of oscillation between...
I would say it's almost all extremely tropey, but like they are all serious subversions of the tropes.
Yeah. And know, have a knowingness about them at lots of times.
Yeah. I think that's sort of true in places. So should we kind of sketch the opening and sort of locate ourselves in the world, and then we can kind of talk around it a bit. You heard in the opening quotation we're in the future. It's 1992. I was trying to look up what happened on this date, and the only thing on Wikipedia is that this was the week that John Major's Cones Hotline was launched, which was the
something I think exclusively for our British listeners of a certain age.
Yes, well, I mean, just now that we've mentioned it, fresh from his election triumph of April 1992, he launched a special phone line you could ring up if you thought that the motorway authorities or local councils were using too many traffic cones without a good reason.
And this was the main. this was the main, we've won this mandate.
Yeah.
What are we going to do with it?
Yeah.
It's the end of history effect.
That's
it's the long middle 90s. Nothing happened.
Yeah. So that's not the 90s that we're in this story. This is a 90s where there are psychics. Mm-hmm. We're going to be located in what's called a prudence organization, which is a kind of anti-psychic sort of Pinkerton type thing, like outfit, who sort of are set up to defend to kind of protect various sorts of businesses and well-off people from the depredations of psychics, who I think themselves are a kind of rival type of kind of detective. And you can talk to the dead.
Well, some of them.
Yeah. We're in New York City. We're going to spend the novel basically in different cities in America and also Switzerland.
And the moon.
And the moon. The locations don't seem to matter very much except for like a little bit of like slightly different kind of sort of scenery.
It would be very easy to do this as a play.
Yeah.
In some ways.
It sort of starts off seeming like it's going to be a kind of noirish, sort of thrillerish type of book. Although it quite quickly...
That beginning is like false advertising.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In a way.
Yeah. And in the beginning, in terms of callback to previous episodes, the thing that it reminded me of more than anything else really was Neuromancer, the William Gibson novel that we've, insofar as it's a kind of sci-fi world with cyberspace or psychic abilities or easy space travel, and there's a kind of thriller, there's a heist maybe going to happen,
yeah,
or a counter heist, you know, it feels like that kind of...
Yeah, for the at the outset, it very quickly changes. I think that the comparison, so Gibson is the last kind of science fiction novelist that we talked about on the show, on, you know, on a maybe a slightly more substantial pretext
maybe
than this
William
one.
Morris.
Oh yeah, William Morris, I guess, is the sci-fi guy. Actually, we talked about lots of science fiction since then, but mostly 19th century ones. I mean, like, one of the kind of differences between like Dick and Gibson is the type of characters. Like, Gibson's characters are all kind of outlaws, or they're kind of like super elites, but they're people who the laws don't apply to and who can do things that normal people can't do. Whereas like Dick's characters are, they're kind of noirish, but they're very much like more or less people in society who have like a TV at home and like eat a certain number of like TV dinners.
And generally spend quite a lot of the novel fairly confused about what's happening.
Yeah.
In a way that Gibson's characters don't.
So yeah, but I mean, in this case, it's slightly different. The main protagonist is like a noir detective who should be struggling with alcoholism, except that he is struggling with pathological incompetence.
Yeah. Yeah, so we should say, so the characters that we meet this guy, Glenn Runciter, who's the head of the firm, and then actually our kind of hero is this guy, Joe Chip, who we meet, I think, kind of hungover in his apartment. There's this long scene which is played broadly for comedy, where he's not able to do anything because all of the appliances in the apartment are coin-operated, and he is in debt to the apartment building in all sorts of different ways, and his credit is kind of completely wrecked. And he's sort of trying to negotiate all of the things necessary to start the day, like having a cup of coffee or whatever else, while being completely unable to pay for anything.
His fridge, his shower, his front door all demand sort of coins to be put in.
But not only that, they are sarcastically voiced.
Yeah.
It's not that they are coin operated, it's that they're coin operated by a sarcastic computer.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's the world is not just making you impotent because you don't have money, it's also laughing at you. He is unable to do anything and constantly being humiliated.
Yeah. Well, and this is one of the moments in the novel that actually feels very prescient in that it reminds me, firstly, of like Internet of Things type, you know, pay a subscription service to make everything in your house work, from your exercise bike to your fridge.
Yeah.
And then also the kind of twee personalities that sometimes are being applied to.
They're sassy.
Yeah.
I think the sass does have a little bit of Alexa about them, don't they?
Yeah.
Like, that's one of the things that all of these, that people are constantly programming into these kind of smart home devices is like something that you can say to it where it will do something funny, which is always pretty nauseating.
Yeah, they're like, it's like the whole world is being run by the sinister, Clippy the sinister Microsoft.
Yeah. It's very, it's broadly like a sort of farce about consumer credit. And
but we've got a very strange kind of genre mashup already, because it's sort of noir detective, sort of American style telepathy and rocket ship, sci-fi, Kafkaesque, horrendous dream sequence, impotence, with elements of like social satire.
Yeah.
All coming together to make it seem even more weird, uncertain, and undermined.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, like, Chip is, he's rescued by the arrival of a colleague from the Prudence organisation who brings with him a girl who's a kind of prospect for this anti-Psy team, which is Pat. Joe's job is that he is the, like, guy with the magic electronics who tests out whether people really have the anti-Psy powers that they think they do.
Yeah, and so we should maybe sketch out that in the world,
yeah,
there are people who have psionic abilities, be they telepaths,
yeah,
be they precogs, which are people who kind of are able to perceive things preternaturally, like what's going to happen.
Yeah, they can see the future.
They can see the future.
See Minority Report.
Yeah, we don't get much detail on others, but the implication is that there's all kinds of different varieties of, like, mutation of human...
It's insinuated that there are people who can raise the dead. That's sort of briefly mentioned. And yeah, there are, like, there seem to be various other ones.
And the kind of outfit that Joe Chip works for is involved with finding people who have a kind of counter ability in their brains that they negate the force of people with other psionic powers, and there's a kind of yin and yang thing going on where they can then market those services to people whose businesses are being targeted by psychics.
This is all kind of run by huckstery business.
And it broadly seems to be like ways for businesses to do like industrial espionage against each other, or to protect against the same.
And then the core business of the Prudence organization is drumming up paranoia. A core thing in the book is you don't know what's going on, and the idea is their job is to make everyone worried that they're being spied on. You can't tell, like, you just give them money and then theoretically you're not being spied on, but you wouldn't know if you were, or you wouldn't know if you weren't.
There's an example of an advert that the Prudence organisation runs where they say, you know, your husband, you don't know if your husband is using his telepathic abilities against you. And so you want to bring us in so that you can kind of... It's like inducing this paranoia into everyone's lives all the time that they might be surrounded by psychics who are destabilising their perception of reality.
I mean, it's definitely one of the things that Dick is a bit obsessed with, is like advertising, TV, and the sort of...
And he's very good at pastiching it.
Yeah, the pastiches are quite funny, and they appear in lots of places in the book.
At the beginning of every chapter, for start.
Yeah. So yeah, we have the arrival of this prospect. She's a very beautiful young girl. She's presently working, maintaining the videophone cables at the Topeka kibbutz, but now she's available for new opportunities. And they have this sort of back and forth between him, the guy who's brought her in, and her about what her sort of anti-psychic abilities are. She has this kind of miraculous anti-psychic ability, which is to counter people who can see the future by going back in time and changing history. Which is sort of kind of crazy and ludicrously powerful. And they sort of play out this whole little kind of farcical thing where she sort of convinces them that this is a real power. And then and later on, she'll do it all again in the office. They all go in and the scene is essentially all played out again where they don't really believe that she's real. And then she does it all over again to Runciter, who's the head of the firm, to sort of demonstrate it again.
It's kind of like, in order to do your party trick, you change the entire course of human history.
Yeah. she does all sorts of things. At one point, she changes history so that her and Joe have got married. And
and their boss has become a coin collector.
Yes. Yeah. And all kinds of other things. There's a bit which is played like broadly for laughs where she's like with Joe, he's doing the kind of questionnaire testing, and she says, can I have a shower? And starts taking off her clothes. And he says, are you sure you want to do that? And she said, well, last time I didn't do that and you didn't like it very much, so I'm going to do it this way instead.
Yeah,
and
he's like the characters, most of the characters in this book are like their motivations are extraordinarily arbitrary.
Yeah.
And,
yeah, she completely their doesn't. Personalities she doesn't make sense at all.
Don't make any sense.
There's an incredible thinness to a lot of the characters generally.
They're very
particularly with her, and I can't tell to what extent is he trying to take the piss out of like noirish femme fatale, like mysterious and sexually alluring women who you can't read and who are incredibly powerful, or is he just like kind of writing that trope?
I don't know. I think it was written quite fast and without sort of worrying too much about certain things. I mean, I think he's definitely conscious of tropes and of having fun with them. But I don't really know exactly what the intent. I would say that Pat in general is quite unresolved.
This character really feels like, or like lots of bits in this book really feel like the writing is just coming along like a steam train.
Yeah.
And anything that isn't kind of worked out in advance is just steamrolled over. So, yeah. You know, things just come, disappear for ages and then just suddenly reemerge briefly and resolve in an incredibly truncated form. And that happens all the time. And it sort of hangs together because it's meant... I can remember, like, a while ago, there was the Banksy theme park called Dismal Land, and the whole thing was, it's meant to be really rubbish. And so whenever it turned out it was rubbish, it was kind of on purpose.
Yeah.
And that seemed genius. And the way this book... I mean, this book, by the way, I think it's fantastic. But part of the way this works is that, like, all these, like, tropes, which just seem superficially to be, like, bad writing, really, they all work because you're meant to be, like, not... certain anything's going on or making any sense, and, and it's all about like destabilizing a reality, the constructed reality, and destabilizing genre and destabilizing characters, and being completely capricious fits with that. So
the reality which you're in the book is one which is a kind of a stage set, and the fact that you're that everything seems like completely paper thin.
Mm. Yeah, just kind of deep. Yes, and improvisation, right?
Yeah.
We kind of glossed over it at the beginning, but there's this other big and important dimension of the science fictional reality which we're in, which is the idea of half-life, which happens in the first chapter. Runster goes to talk to his dead wife, Ella, who is who's been dead for ages, and she died very young. And he likes to go and talk to her. And he's able to do that because she's kept in this state where they're locked. It's a kind of cryogenesis. They're sort of in a type of like big vacuum flask with a porthole. And she's described as having her little sort of hands up in front of her face like this. You can kind of talk to them on the telephone. You dial into them and they can communicate with you through a kind of psychic shortwave radio. And there are... She's located in Geneva in what's called a moratorium, which is like a big kind of funeral home for the not quite dead, which is run by this like very twee guy called Dr. Fogelsang. And you kind of go down... You go there and, yeah, you kind of keep your... You can keep your relatives on ice for a period of... decades, as long as you don't want to talk to them that often.
Yeah,
you can kind of
there's sort of a ticking clock
for
how many hours of kind of active mental interaction they can put up over the rest of their half life.
Yeah,
and you've got to kind of use that sparingly.
Yeah,
so I think when Runster goes to see Ella in the beginning of the book, he says that he's not been to see her in 20 years.
Yeah,
and he sort of lies to her. Or implies that it's only been a couple of years since he last saw her.
Yeah. And, yeah, you kind of dial into them. They're sort of kind of sweet, dreamy. They sound like someone who's just woken up on the telephone. And they're kind of, like, intermittently available. They're obviously experiencing their own... They're kind of in a dream. And... Or that sort of scene, that's the kind of impression you get at the start. And then that whole chapter ends with this sort of weird moment of kind of interference where wires are crossed and he finds himself talking to the teenager in the casket next to hers, who's kind of coming through much stronger on the radio, who's a fellow called Jory, who says that he's lonely and wants to talk to someone. And the whole sort of encounter, well, he's got what he wanted out of out of Ella, but that whole kind of encounter ends rather unsatisfactorily. But the idea of Half-Life and this strange dream world that the half-alive are kept in is at the heart of the book, and it's kind of important.
I mean, what we've got here is like a really good example of... I haven't read a lot of Philip K. Dick at all. I've read a small amount. But this seems very much like the strength of his sort of method, which is a real incredible superfluity of ideas.
Mm.
But the way they are constructed is almost kind of collided. Is like the novel... What book had the novel kaleidoscopes? 1984.
Yeah.
Like, she worked in the like novel factory, like, yeah, like cranking out things. And Philip K. Dick is a bit like a novel kaleidoscope with these sci-fi ideas. So what you've got is a medium...
Mm.
Are you coming through?
Yeah.
Mm.
And the character seance, the kind of character is coming through, and then are we sure who it is? Who's it for? And the voice kind of bubbles up like they'd been nattering away at some other conversation, and they kind of tune in. Combined with a sort of extremely desacralized by this like sleazy commercial setup.
Big corporate warehouse full of your dead loved ones.
Yeah, and they're kind of in like plastic Lenin caskets with kind of engraved, like they feel like it's like a Lenin casket, but kind of made of plastic, acrylic, with kind of like laser etched roses on them or something, you know, like really cheesy. It's got a kind of whole notion about like life and existence, which is going on at the same time, which is incredibly evocative. This ability to communicate nearly but not quite with the dead. I find it incredibly fruitful, but like you can sort of see how it's generated as well. It's taking a combination of, like a number of things that existed in the world and tropes and smashing them together.
Yeah,
and I mean, on the corporate sleaziness of it, when Runciter loses the call to Ella with this young boy coming on the line, the proprietor of the moratorium sort of says, oh, well, you know, if you increase your subscription, if you pay a little bit more a month, then we could put her in isolation and we could protect her with lead linings from the psychic interference. This very evocative and very like meaningful premise of connection, but then, as with everything in the book, like cheapened by money.
But not just money, it's the whole kind of... because the money itself is a sort of cipher for a kind of commercial glossiness.
Mm.
Yeah.
The presentation.
Yeah.
Mm.
Shall we get to the kind of pivotal moment in the book, and then maybe that will... We can then kind of...
I'm glad you feel that there was one.
Well, there's a point where everything changes. So we've assembled the team. We've had this funny sort of sketch review of like different types of scenes. The like sad, the sort of thrillerish opening, the sad bit in the moratorium, this like farce in Joe Chip's apartment. We kind of get everyone together in the office. Yeah, Runciter has a big job, which is allegedly for the richest man in the galaxy, Stanton Mick, who is some kind of very rich guy, and who thinks that his operations are being disrupted by psychics. And they think, aha, that's where all the psychics have gone. They've gone somewhere off planet. And Runciter, he's sort of told to assemble a great big team, and they're all going to go off to an undisclosed location to go and do a bit of anti-psychic work and make a lot of money in the process. And so they all go and do that. They go to Mars. We have
Luna.
The moon. Moon. Think.
Yeah. Sorry. Not that it makes any difference.
It might as well be Milton Keynes.
I mean, I wanted to touch briefly on the kind of flatness.
Yeah.
Of the descriptions. Generally, it's not a kind of science fiction writing that is in any way at all interested in describing, like the rocket or how it's just that they get in the rocket and then they are at the moon.
Yeah.
You know what
The rocket is described, but it's described... I mean, lots of things are described, but they're not described for their technological purpose. It's not gleaming and... Or if there is a technological purpose, it's to kind of undermine it or make it sound silly. It's described, but it's described because of, like, setting out this kind of, like, swanky office interior to describe the character of the boss.
Yeah.
It's not like, you know... thrusters don't engage. Gravity beams do not bounce off particle discs.
The setting is, yeah, they're like very flat, very generic locations. There's no, like, some of his books have a real interest in like sort of weird landscapes and things. There are some of the, like, I sort of remember Martian Time Slip has like a lot of like interest in the kind of sort of weird landscapes of Mars and this kind of thing. It's definitely something which he can do, and so it's a deliberate decision that everything is kind of flat, generic, essentially interior, and that to the extent that there is a sort of set, it's the occasional appearance of like heroic products, like the magnificent pseudo mahogany dresser, four variegated cryptochrome plated reclining chairs. Or, you know, in Runciter's office, there are kind of various... There's, like, the desk and the...
luxury furniture.
Yeah.
In the small amount of his novels that I all bought and short stories that I've read, descriptions exist only to do something.
Yeah.
A landscape is described to like, create a psychological setting.
Yeah.
Or to reflect an inner state. They don't exist for their own purposes.
Yeah, but it's also, yeah, I mean, it's a kind of a, it's sort of particularly like and deliberately limited, I think. And it's also, he sort of describes the sort of products and kind of luxury objects kind of in their own terms, like it sounds like advertising copy in the way that it's described. It's not like, you know, when William Gibson would describe something, he sort of often describes it like super materially. It's like the foam, yes. The foam mattress, the water-saturated plywood, the kind of the like
but also
epoxy.
He has places, you know, which are in there because they're cool sci-fi locations, and he enjoys the cool sci-fi. You know, his spinning space station, which becomes narrower at the ends, and that has a particular property, which is really just about a cool sci-fi location.
Yeah,
that does not occur here at all. And yeah, I think it's because the more you concretely describe things, you ground.
Yeah,
you ground reality at that moment.
Yeah,
yeah. Well, I mean, on that, there are these very strange descriptions of the clothes of the 1990s.
Oh yeah,
that crop up at various points in the book, which, yeah, I don't know. Is I might just read a couple if that's.
Oh yeah, you've got. Yeah, I've got some.
I've got a couple written down. Yeah. So one person is described as wearing an electric yellow cummerbund, a petal skirt, knee-hugging hose, and a military-style visored cap. Someone else is wearing ersatz vicuna trousers and a grey sweatshirt on which had been printed a now faded full-face portrait of Bertrand Lord Russell.
See if you can guess who this one is. Fuchsia pedal pushers, pink yak fur slippers, a snakeskin sleeveless blouse, and a ribbon in his waist-length dyed hair.
One of the psychics?
No, that's Stanton Mick. That's their client.
Oh, fantastic.
He's the richest man in the world.
He's the Elon Musk of this this timeline.
And I thought of what are these doing? I could think of three things that I could think they're doing. One, they make the world alien. Exotic sci-fi location. Two, they're very funny and they make the reading the text easier.
Yeah.
So it's a very rich mixture of like contradictions. And I think that he's very interested in having people read. Like that beginning is very clearly that, like, what is the job of the first sentence to get you to read the second sentence?
Yeah.
and like, that's absolutely what's going on. And to some extent, and the third thing is, I think he just really likes writing them because they're funny. And he has, you know, the whole thing is rather like his continuous marketing pastiches. He's clearly got, there's an efflorescence of like these comical ideas in his mind and he just puts them out.
Their function, I think, is to be kind of absurd. And I think, but also they kind of create this tension with one of the prevailing sort of moods of the novel, which is kind of like depression or, you know, the world kind of sinking into decay, this sense of time slowing down, of being overwhelmed by coldness, and these kind of like ludicrously overdone outfits kind of create a sort of a sort of absurd counterpoint, but which is sort of reinforcing, at least. That's what I think.
Mm. Yeah, reinforcing and leveling. The whole thing just being, I don't know what's true, and the environment is kind of psychological terror combined with apathy.
Yeah.
Which is a kind of dream state. But yeah. I think the reason why people compare it to Kafka is because it's like that. They're both dream states.
Mm.
So we've got everyone onto this moon base.
Yep.
They do like a little bit of orienteering. There are various like little, there's a little sort of absurd conversation first with the assistant and then with Stanton Mick himself. And then this happens. Squeaking in his metal insect voice, Stanton Mick floated to the ceiling of the room, his arms protruding distendedly and rigidly. Mr. Runciter, don't let your thalamus override your cerebral cortex. This matter calls for discretion, not haste. Calm your people down and let's huddle together in an effort to mutually understand. His rotund, colourful body bobbed about, twisting in a slow transversal rotation so that now its feet, rather than his head, extended in Runciter's direction. I've heard of this, Runciter said to Joe. It's a self-destruct humanoid bomb. Help me get everybody out of here. They just now put it on auto. That's why it floated upward. The bomb exploded. It's sort of like weirdly kind of underemphasized moment. Like very, very undramatic, but also like really eerie and weird image. There's this like, this guy who sort of seems, he comes across as this kind of like slightly Hugh Hefner-ish.
Richard Branson.
Yeah, Branson.
More Branson than Elon Musk.
Yeah, sort of Branson-ish like sex dwarf guy in his in his like absurd outfit, who then suddenly starts, his voice is getting higher and higher and higher, and then he floats up to the ceiling.
He starts inflating, and then explodes.
Yeah,
and everyone about is kind of like getting a lot. You know, they've all been given these like
little maps of
little maps and little like sweetie wrappers full of coins to use coin-operated like hair dryers or whatever. Yeah. And they're all kind of wandering around like that, and this guy just floats up to the ceiling and no one really pays any attention, and then one of them goes, that's a humanoid bomb. Please, can you help me get everybody
Please
out
help me
of
get
here?
Everyone.
That's a humanoid bomb.
We need to get everybody out of here. But this extra bit of exposition. They just now put it on auto. This kind of like flattened affect and expression at what ought to be a moment of like the highest tension and panic is very, very characteristic for me of the sort of mood of the book. When the smoke clears... Oh no, Glenn Runciter's dead. Or it's sort of described in a slightly weird way, like someone says, oh, they've killed him. And then Joe Ship thinks, no, they haven't killed him, he's not dead. And then he looks at him a bit more and then he says, actually, I can see he's about to die. And then they take him back.
Yeah.
Or it's sort of, it's like weird, it's a weird thing to kind of...
Nobody responds in the natural,
no.
in a naturalistic way to what's happening at all.
No.
Not least the fact that a bomb has gone off inside a room on a lunar base.
Yeah.
And only one person has been killed by it.
One person's killed and the other two, the two kind of antagonists seem to have disappeared.
Yeah.
And then they kind of have to make their way back onto the ship. It all happens quite laboriously. There's even a moment where they go on a travelator and it seems to be going incredibly slowly. They're all like, do you have a gun? Let's find a gun in case they're going to try and kill us another way.
Is there a lift? Is the lift coming?
Who's got guns?
Yeah.
I've got a gun. I've got a gun as well. Mine's in my purse.
I think mine's in my suitcase somewhere.
Yeah. So they kind of get it. They have to get the keys. There's some special keys that they need to get out of his pocket. But the aim, obviously, is they've got to get Runciter into Cold Pack so that he can be put into Half-Life. And then he can
have this.
And he can continue
after death,
to. Yeah.
They can go and find out what they need to do next.
And he can, you know, attend the quarterly meetings of the board of directors and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And that's all very important. They've got to try and do that. And so, and they do it and it all, but there's something off about the mood. It's very cold. Everything seems to be happening very, very slowly. No one can quite understand what's happened. Basically, this part of the novel after the bomb is them taking him to a moratorium while all the time something seems to be a bit off.
Yes.
About the whole of the kind of world. And it's at this point that the most memorable moments in the book are the things which start to happen at this point. This sort of sense that something is just a bit off with the world. And it's kind of expressed through a whole series of like weird little, a little bit like kind of paranoid observations about the world.
Mm.
So for a start, the first thing that happens is that people keep trying to smoke a cigarette and all of their cigarettes are stale. And they seem to be not just stale, but like incredibly stale. They kind of fall apart in their hands. And then Joe Chip tries to get a coffee and the coffee is like got mold on it. Yeah.
The cream has gone off straight out of the fridge.
Everything seems to be off.
The phone book, all the numbers in the phone book are like several years out of date.
Yeah, the phone book on the spaceship, obviously, you've got to have one on the spaceship, is out of date. Yeah, and then there's this kind of moment where they're sort of trying to pay for things and lots of the money is out of date, or the money is kind of weird. And then at a certain point, some of the money has an unfamiliar head on it. They say, shouldn't the 50 cent have Fidel Castro's head? No, it should have Walt Disney's head on it.
Yes.
Or Fidel Castro.
If it's old.
If it's old, yeah. But in fact, it's got neither. It looks a lot like the head of Glenn Runciter. And there is this kind of like general sort of gradually building sense that something is kind of profoundly off, that reality has kind of started to break down in some kind of way. This is far from the only Dick novel where this kind of thing happens. There's in a number of his other novels, there's a thing of taking some drugs, going on a drug trip, and never really being sure whether the trip has ended again. You never quite come back from it.
And you can tell it's a psychologically orientated thing because of the response again, his response is he becomes tired and irritated with it.
Yeah.
The world is stopping making sense and he's just getting ratty with it.
Yeah.
Like he's being frustrated by all these things going wrong. Traveling to the moon is incredibly easy. Traveling up a travelator is incredibly hard.
Yeah.
Opening a door is impossible.
Walking
Everything
up the stairs,
turns to dust in his hands and he's just getting really ratty.
Yeah.
That's a feverish psychological state.
Yeah.
Literally at various points to try and counteract this, he's asking for the various ubiquitous pharmacological salves that are available in this consumerist world. Basically, like, everywhere has complementary amphetamines.
Oh, yeah.
All sedatives, you know.
All psychedelics.
All the time everybody has access to the... And that's definitely, like, well, probably also what Dick had access to when he was writing it.
Yeah. I mean, he was definitely used quite a lot of drugs. Got quite a lot done.
He said the first novel he wrote without amphetamines was The Scanner Darkly.
Ah, really?
Mm.
Interesting. Which is quite a late one.
That's most of the way through, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not sure that they were great for him. But, I mean, obviously produced some interesting discoveries. Psychologically.
The world is continuing to become strange. Yeah. Things seem to be being substituted in the background, and there's entropy is taking things turn to dust in his hands, and some other people are noticing, but mostly not.
But then also some people start to succumb to these effects, and in one moment he finds one of his team members sort of dried up and mummified in the wardrobe of his hotel room.
Yeah, that's about...
A thing that he is also pretty, pretty passé about. He sort of bags her up in a...
Yeah, he puts her in a plastic bag.
Puts her on the ship.
There's this sort of weird moment where they have a big meeting with the legal counsel. Mm. And then he's like, to one of the colleagues, he's like, oh yeah, send Wendy round to my room afterwards.
I feel a terrible need for her.
Yeah.
And the colleague is like, wouldn't that be very... No, he's like, but it would be too inappropriate. And the colleague's like, what is good for you is good for the business.
Good for the business. Oh, my God, yeah. Yeah, unfortunately, she suffers a terrible fate on the way.
She turns into a mummy.
And, is entirely kind of dried up. succumbs to this kind of accelerated entropy. I think we should just say what's going on, because I think
We should say, we should insert at the beginning that we are going to comprehensively spoil this.
Yeah.
Thing. Cool. Okay. So I'll spoil it now. So what's happened is that all of this is the wrong way around. It's actually Runciter who's alive, and it's all of them who are dead and are in Half-Life, and they're kind of connected to each other, and they're experiencing this kind of shared dream world. And these sort of intrusions into their world, where Runciter starts appearing on the coins, and he also, Joe Chip starts, encountering weird little notes from him. Like, at one point he buys a pack of cigarettes from the store to see whether they're all stale, as all the other ones have been, and he, finds a weird note hidden in the pack that comes out of the vending machine. Or he appears in, a television commercial at one point tries to talk to them.
The pack of cigarettes is, they go, okay, is it going wrong everywhere in the world? Choose a city at random. Let's go to Baltimore.
Yeah.
Okay, we're in Baltimore.
Let's go to a supermarket.
Let's go to a supermarket. Okay, we're in a supermarket. Let's get some cigarettes.
Yeah.
Those are off-brand cigarettes. You need brand cigarettes. He shakes it.
Yeah.
There's a note inside.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and there's a suggestion briefly when they're trying to fight through the mist that is everywhere that's blocking anyone from making sense of what's going on. They briefly have an idea that maybe Glenn Runciter used a precog to tell that he was going to die on the moon, and that he has set up all of these messages for them in advance because he knew from a psychic. So the advert that appears on the television, which is a message from Runciter, they're like, well, maybe Glenn did this before he died, and he bought this advertising space and he recorded this advert, and maybe he planted the note in the cigarettes before, and he knew that it was going to happen, which I only bring up because it is literally the plot of, and I had two moments in this of suddenly realizing how influential this has been subsequently, but that motif is the plot of an episode of Doctor Who, from the David Tennant era, where he's stuck in the 1970s and he puts various hidden messages in.
Well, I mean,
VHS tapes.
One thing that you can definitely say about Philip K. Dick is that he had a lot of ideas.
Yeah.
His execution is quite good, but his ideas are really fantastic and excessive.
Yeah.
There are too many ideas, and they've been extensively mined because a lot of little ideas can be expanded out. He did also use the same ideas again and again and again with this kind of kaleidoscopic reimagining of them.
Yeah. So the kind of, I guess that we could talk.
Oh, the thing I was going to say is you've confidently stated this is what is happening, which is kind of right. That's probably the kind of main idea of what's happening, but it is also something which is repeatedly, deliberately undermined.
Yeah,
to make it so that it's not really clear, not undermined in such a way that you think that there's some sort of eminence degrees controlling everything, but that nothing makes sense deliberately.
Yeah, it doesn't all line up. So this sort of weird, surreal world which they exist on in is characterized by, there are sort of weird hidden messages coming from Runciter. And there is this phenomenon of kind of accelerated entropy, which they experience in all sorts of different ways. The entropy, I think, is the weirdest and most memorable one, which it has kind of different versions. There's one where things go mouldy and they kind of go off, or they die and become completely kind of hollowed out or whatever. This happens not only to kind of foodstuffs and perishables and people, but also to sort of technical objects and products and all of the various kinds of bright and shiny luxury goods that we've been encountering in the novel throughout. Some of them undergo a kind of accelerated entropy. They seem kind of worn out, but more often they regress to a kind of earlier version of the product from history. So
I can read a passage where this happens. So this is Joe Chip in his kitchen. The living room smelled faintly of burned grease, an odour he had not come across since childhood. Going into the kitchen, he discovered the reason. His stove had reverted. back to an ancient Buck natural gas model with clogged burners and encrusted oven door, which did not close entirely. He gazed at the old, much-used stove dully, then discovered that the other kitchen appliances had undergone similar metamorphoses. The homier paper machine had vanished entirely. The toaster had dissolved sometime during the day and reformed itself as a rubbishly quaint, non-automatic model. Not even pop-up, he discovered as he poked bleakly at it. The refrigerator that greeted him was an enormous belt-driven model, a relic that had floated into being from God knew what distant past. It was even more obsolete than the current turret-top GE shown in the TV commercial. The coffee pot had undergone the least change. As a matter of fact, in one respect, it had improved. It lacked the coin slot, operating obviously toll-free. The aspect was true of all the appliances, he realised. All that remained, anyhow. Like the homeopathic machine, the garbage disposal unit had entirely vanished. He tried to remember what other appliances he had owned, but already memory had become vague. He gave up and returned to the living room.
Couple of thoughts on that. One of which is that, like, it's really nice having descriptions of these things that were present in the 1960s when this novel. Like, I have an idea of what a turret top fridge is like. It's one with a big radiator, a round radiator on the top for cooling it. And in fact, my grandfather had like a fridge that ran on fuel oil, which seemed like, how does this work? Like, you put fuel in it, there's a burner, which then powers something, which then cools things down in the fridge. But the more significant one is, you sort of see things that's... This reversion is something which is psychological, not... it's not hard sci-fi technology going on. This isn't physics entropy. This is psychological horror entropy.
Yeah, sure, it's kind of nostalgia. It's like things remembered.
Things are nostalgic, but sometimes they're like... Sometimes they're just old or obsolescent. Sometimes they're old and worn out.
Yeah.
Sometimes they're dysfunctional.
They're they've sort of become dirty as well as old. Mm. But they're also they're much more, they're the kind of categories of like objects of desire, or they're the sort of social categories of like technical products, rather than there's nothing literal. It's not literally material. It's the archetype of a certain.
Well, he talks at one point in explicitly Neoplatonic terms about the idea of a kind of animus or a spirit that flows through. From the
spirit of
horse-drawn
fridge,
carriage to the rocket ship.
That's just Platonic, not Neoplatonic.
Platonic.
Yeah, it is Platonic. Yeah, in Dick, you get like occasional info dumps from something he's been.
Yeah,
reading.
Like they're quoting Gnostic scripture as well, and bits of the Bible and things early on.
It's like a Manichaean, like big good versus evil.
The world comes to be kind of characterized by. This collision of forces. There is a bad force at work in the world, which is creating this kind of entropy and is gradually, killing they're killing off the team one by one. And then there is a kind of countervailing good force who is trying to help them, which is personified mostly by Glenn Runciter appearing in various places. I might read a quick quote, actually. Here he is popping up on the television. "Tired of lazy taste buds," Runciter said in his familiar gravelly voice. "Has boiled cabbage taken over your world of food? That same old, stale, flat, Monday morning odour, no matter how many dimes you put in your stove. Ubik changes all that. Ubik wakes up food flavour, puts hearty taste back where it belongs, and restores fine food smell. One invisible puff-puff whisk of economically priced Ubik banishes compulsive, obsessive fears that the entire world is turning into clotted milk, worn-out tape recorders and obsolete iron cage elevators, plus other further as-yet-unglimpsed manifestations of decay. You see, world deterioration of this regressive type is a normal experience of many half-lifers, especially in the early stages, when ties to the real reality are still very strong." We haven't actually said what Ubik is, but he sort of has said it there.
Well, to some extent, it's a MacGuffin in this story as well.
It's a kind of, it's a kind of magical product which appeared in many ways, but really it is the, like, emanation of this good force which is able to come into the Joe Chip and the others' world and fight against this kind of accelerated decay, which is this kind of demonic evil force sort of pursuing them and gradually destroying the world. But as you say, this is basically, yeah, this is like a kind of Gnostic dualism, or it's a kind of Manichaean. It's basically the idea, which actually there's quite a lot of evidence for in the Bible, that the world was created. There's a bad god and a good god.
Yeah, the Demiurge, right, is the name of the bad god.
But basically, there's bad god, good god. Good god is ultimately more powerful but more distant. Good god lives in heaven. Heaven belongs to good god, and the world belongs to bad god. You kind of have to move away from the world and the bad god towards the good god. And you do that through getting past the illusion and moving towards enlightenment and increasing your like contact with the little tendrils that the good god sends into the world.
My understanding of Gnosticism and the Cathars is pretty limited, but they are both like religious spiritual tendencies,
yeah,
both of which rely on cryptic knowledge, which is achieved through becoming closer in more closely involved in the kind of cult.
Yeah, they're kind of mystery religions.
And that state of like you are uncertain of the truth of the world.
Yeah,
I think it's seem relevant to this, but I think really what Ubik feels like is something which is a set of kind of writing tools which are to create this kind of atmosphere as well.
Yeah,
I mean, he has a number of kind of hobby horses: your perception of reality because of mental illness or existential terror or drug use, but there's a lot of just like tools to create an atmosphere in the reader of being unsettled, and he's very much enjoying amping up the degree of uncertainty in the reader. Also various different senses of foreboding and dread. I think so much of the book to me feels like a series of kind of tricks to kind of construct this feeling of closed, uncertain, insecurity, more than, and I think all these like bits of archaic reference are tools to make you uncertain or unsure, or the idea that there could be something out there but you can't understand what it is.
Well, I think also they're just like bits of the process that creep into the story, because he kind of can't help himself like making a little reference to them and talking about them. But I don't think, you know, I think that there's an approach to reading Dick which is very much about like trying to decode the references and understand, you know, that's a kind of Gnostic, approach to reading.
I don't think that's really very helpful.
No, I tend to agree. I don't think that is, I'm not sure like the Gnostic reading of Dick really enhances the enjoyment of it that much.
But I don't think you're also going to find anything. I mean, I suppose the process of paranoid analysis could be quite fun.
You'll get to enlightenment.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, you'll get to enlightenment. You'll escape the clutches of the Demiurge. I mean, Ubik itself can also decay. Really the sort of last part of the book, there's like one or two revelations. Everyone gets killed off in pretty short order, apart from Joe Chip. And there is a kind of revelation of, there's a kind of personification of this like antagonist who turns out to be Jory, this teenage half-lifer. And he turns out to effectively be the kind of demiurge behind all of these bad accelerated entropy phenomena that have been going on. And also, in some way, he's also the person who's kind of creating the simulated reality that they're inside. But the kind of the rest of the story is really Joe Chip trying with like varying degrees of
commitment
to maybe escape from his clutches, maybe find what he needs to do is find some Ubik and spray it on himself. This is all like a lot like a sort of frustration dream, isn't it?
Yeah,
but like he sort of runs into this thing where, oh no, the Ubik has regressed.
And the physical environment keeps going backwards in time.
Yeah.
Like he suddenly finds himself in the 1930s.
Yeah.
Like along with all of the material objects in his house are going back in time. Also physically the environment and the people are going backwards in time. And we have a very long, odd conversation with a taxi driver about like, 1930s American politics, where he is basically saying the taxi driver is sort of talking about how much he hates the communists, how much he loves the Nazis.
Rush Limbaugh was right. Not the terrible misrepresentations of him in the mainstream media.
Not Rush Limbaugh, Charles Lindbergh. Similar politics.
Freudian slip. Lindy Hop and Aviator.
The only other Dick novel that I've actually read is The Man in the High Castle.
Yeah.
And that is a kind of speculative, kind of counterfactual fiction, historical fiction, which imagines that the Americans lose World War II, right? But in that, he's really interested in the idea that the kind of historical memory of the war that exists within society will keep changing and shifting according to like the outcome of it, you know, and that everything that people think they know about the war in the 1960s in our reality is wrong, as is things that people think they know about the war in the alternate reality as well.
Yeah.
And he has the kind of spiritual route of like I Ching meditation to mediate those different historical parts. But that felt very resonant. It's clearly he's got a bugbear about like his lifetime, about changing perceptions of history during his lifetime, and that material culture and products in a strange way offer a like connection to the past or a way to remember how things were.
Yeah.
But then also they've got, as well.
They've got a kind of, they're sort of ambivalent, aren't they? Because the Ubik, this kind of, this like intercession of the divine into the mundane world is just like all different products. And products are kind of miraculous and they sort of construct reality, but they're also clearly like super manipulative and kind of working against people in some way. They have this, they're kind of magical and they're not exactly good or bad. They're sort of, but they are kind of like animist spirits or something.
It's a strange thing, the idea of the thing from the previous world, because it makes me think again of 1984 where he has to go back to like, in both of these cases, I mean, we think of the 30s as being a long time ago. But when the novel was written, it was, I mean, presumably that was
It was like the 90s now.
Yeah, like the 90s. Yeah. It's stuff that, in both in recent memory and also the youth of the people reading the book.
Yeah.
Which kind of, and these kind of political stories, which I guess the war was then, are recent, fresh, relevant news in a sort of way. But in 1984, it's a relatively recent, it's only, 20 years on or whatever it is, 40 years on. And there's still these things from the past, but the things are like open to different interpretations or on their own. Like they clearly say something was different, but they don't say what.
There's a moment when Joe Chip finds himself suddenly back in the 30s and meeting people from the 30s. One of the first things that they all comment on is how weird his clothes are. As per the descriptions of these insane ersatz, alligator skin, tweed togas and things. Dick knows that kind of dress and that and products and that material culture are kind of define the way that we are blocked off from the past.
I think he is also interested in a kind of quasi-like magical relationship to products and kind of between consumers and products. It's something which sort of comes into some of his other stories as well. There's a short story which I think we've both read called Pay for the Printer, which is one where there's been a nuclear war and the world was like completely reduced to ashes. And then luckily these big aliens came from Alpha Centauri, attracted by the nuclear war, who are these like big magical amoebas. And the thing which they can do is that they can replicate any object. And so kind of 60s consumer society like reassembles itself. And everyone is like living in houses and driving cars again. And it's thanks to the fact that they can find kind of original consumer objects and multiply them using these magic amoebas. And then, yeah, everything is sort of going, but there's no, there's nothing underlying any of it. No one knows how to make anything.
Mm.
There's like no sort of productive, there's no kind of like general sort of understand. It's
everything is slowly also turning back into ash.
Yeah, well, the problem is that the, so in the story, the amoebas have started to die and they can no longer replicate things with complete fidelity. They come out, are they, what do they say? That they have like a funny word for it anyway. Like, you know, like the
puddinged.
They're puddinged. Yeah, they're puddings. Puddinged. They're, yeah, like the watch will have the hands stuck to the dial, or the like.
Inside, it's just like it looks like
clockwork, but it's.
But they're just all.
Yeah.
Yeah. They've got like a Star Trek replicator.
Yeah.
But it keeps doing things.
But it's not
the Star Trek replicator. Bungled. Is a strange creature which yeah. has been like. Which has kind of come here, become yeah. sterile, and is yeah. slowly
dying,
extinct, having been yeah. weirdly domesticated.
They have, excellent. But they're sort of, it's this idea of a society in which the everyone kind of knows by sight what things are meant to be like, and
but
for
no
a
one
while,
can make
no one can make anything, yeah. and no one understands anything. And they, I guess, there's a kind of infantilization, and there's also, I guess, a sort of relationship which is a bit like sort of spectacular or kind of simulated.
It's,
you know,
it's yeah, a kind, it's also like leisure society consumerism.
Yeah,
because all the things that are presented are like, that's a Ronson's lighter.
Yeah.
My 1957 Buick.
Yeah.
You know, that particular lawnmower.
But there, yeah, I think he has an intuition that this sort of relationship of consumers to products is kind of like...
pretty fallout, isn't it?
Well, no, but it's also like, it's like quasi-magical, or it's like quasi... Yeah. Yeah, it's like yeah. it's like believing in magic. It's a kind of thing. It's sort of cargo. It's like living in a cargo cult
yeah.
basically.
But it's also got a little bit of aura.
Yeah.
You know, like what in Walter Benjamin's The Work of Art in the Age of Mechanical Reproduction, where he talks about the kind of the sense, the innate sense of the handcrafted like great work yeah. of art, the sculpture or the painting or whatever.
Yeah.
And the kind of the mental relationship we have
yeah.
to reproductions of things
yeah.
is shifted.
Yeah.
And it's a social relation problem. And it's
here they're all items are given aura by marketing.
Yeah.
Yes.
Which is the only cultural medium that exists in this novel.
Yeah.
Is marketing.
Yeah.
In various different forms, is advertising.
Yeah.
And really, the thing he is most interested in is the marketed brand of the object.
Yeah.
Mm.
It's not the object, the rocket ship. I mean, some things are described a bit, but their descriptions are mainly brand descriptions. They're mainly marketing descriptions. They're descriptions as you would find in a catalogue, rather than descriptions that you would... That you would kind of they're not word pictures.
No, they're yeah. It's like
they're
it's kind
marketing
of
specs.
It's magic advertising copy. Yeah, the object can kind of like transcend its purely material character through the magic of like, yeah, adverts.
Yeah, and in a way, Ubik is also the mythical MacGuffin in this story is the thing that can make rubbish stuff into the image in the marketing.
Yeah.
Yes.
But it's interesting
through faith.
I'm not sure it's true. It's not really true in Ubik, but I think in The Man in the High Castle and in a number of other Dick novels, often these kind of quasi-angelic characters are craftspeople. There are like people who make sort of ceramics or they...
There's a really interesting thing that happens in Man in the High Castle, which is that basically Japan's taken over the western coast of the United States and there's a huge burgeoning trade for bourgeois Japanese families in like historical souvenirs of like the Civil War and stuff,
which
right?
are all fake,
which like... are all fake, and they don't, and there's this huge black market of forgeries of Smith and Wesson pistols from the Civil War and this kind of stuff.
Yeah,
and they are all kind of dead. They all kind of lack spirit.
Yeah,
but then when given the
Eastern European Nazi memorabilia.
Yeah,
yeah. Well, no, exactly. Well, and he's definitely, you know, he's definitely flipping like, also American government and military dignitaries living in Japan under, yeah, like, MacArthur in the post-war period in our reality, where they were collecting lots of Japanese memorabilia, yeah, and Japanese, you know, authentic ethnographic architects of Japanese-ness. Anyway, the thing that allows someone at one point to break out of the world that they're, this fake reality that they're, this counterfactual reality that they're stuck in, is a piece of authentically crafted jewelry. Functions as an object of meditation through which someone snaps out of that wrong world and into ours.
Yeah, that's such a weird moment, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. That true Geist channeling, yeah, handcrafted manufactured goods,
yeah,
that are not lies,
yeah,
can sort of give you that authentic,
yeah, kind of
Gnostic.
It contains the reality, doesn't,
yeah,
it? That's such a weird, it's like a slightly under-remembered, but I think very compelling bit of that book. Like the, yeah, he sort of meditates on the jewelry and then he kind of goes out for a walk and he's on the actual Embarcadero in actual San Francisco in the actual present day.
Yeah.
He's like, what the hell is going on? And people are like being really racist to him, which they obviously, yeah, would not dare to do in the world of Japanese supremacy.
Yeah.
And all this kind of, yeah, it's such a kind
but
of weird moment.
That happens many times.
Yeah.
In this, in Ubik, it's a different thing that, yeah, happens, which is almost the same, which we can describe, but in Pay for the Printer, there is something real which has been made, which is, yeah, like someone has made like a wooden bowl.
They've made like stone age, like primitive tools. Yeah, it's,
and
yeah,
there's a real like diehard conservatism in Philip K. Dick. He doesn't like leisure. He likes labor, craft.
Yeah,
he thinks that marketing is like the sort of new world is wrong. What people should do is work an honest job, making, yeah, something with their hands, not engaging in any of this new fancy pants stuff, which is all bullshit.
Yeah.
And they should get back to being weavers and doing proper jobs.
Well, he's nostalgic for it, but the nostalgia is obviously like a bit ambivalent. Like, he has chosen to be a science fiction novelist, yeah, which is
for
sort
sure
of difficult to do if you're,
for sure,
if you're,
but like,
you
that's
know,
definitely a strain which isn't like necessarily,
it's a feeling,
the
it's
thing
a, it's
which
a, it's a kind of
out,
a,
and it comes up again and again,
yeah, yeah,
and again.
Yeah, 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 it's, yeah, a definite emotional feeling in the book, isn't it?
In Ubik, it's different. It's that actually what you can do in this strange alternative reality is, if you have enough faith, you can generate the marketing truth,
yeah,
through your faith in Ubik,
yeah,
that things will be just like in the advertisement.
Yeah.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, and he, in, you know, in the end, he is able to,
but
kind
you have
of
to, it has to be blind faith.
Yeah,
and it will come.
Yeah, he's able. Yeah. He's able to save himself through learning how to generate Ubik, and he's able to sort of spray it on himself and keep himself.
Yeah,
keep,
well,
himself,
yeah, I
alive.
Mean, we should here do the big end spoiler of the novel, which is that it kind of maybe turns out this whole situation in a very grand overarching way maybe has been manufactured by Ella,
or
the
maybe,
dead, or maybe,
also,
not, but,
or maybe
one,
not.
But maybe, maybe the, yeah, whole situation was manufactured by Ella, Runciter's dead wife, from the very beginning of the novel, in order to kind of break herself out of,
yeah,
the half-life to conquer Jewelry, the kind of demiurge kid,
yeah,
who's living a cannibalistic life in the moratorium,
yeah,
sort of vampirically sucking up everyone else's energy, and that she's sort of empowered Joe Chip as her, you know, son on Earth,
she's
to
she's
win
a spirit guide,
yeah,
as well. And,
yeah,
she might be like trying to search for a better Buddhist reincarnation.
Yes.
But also, the whole thing might be Glenn Runciter is in a weird alternative reality and merely thinks that this is happening to Joe Chip.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Or,
I might read the very, like, the,
like,
very end of,
like,
the,
and it's really doubt that is the truth.
I mean, there are bits in the book which are, which feel like kind of literalized descriptions of sort of psychosis or kind of like paranoid schizophrenia. this thing, the moment when the like television starts talking to you, or you start reading the back of a packet of cigarettes and it starts like telling you what to do.
It's definitely altered states of consciousness.
Is a kind of, you know, this is a sort of a kind of psychosis that does really happen to people, and which I think he was kind of interested in. I think he probably quite a lot of
books also about it. I'm sure he was experiencing some, not exactly that.
Yeah.
Well, I have nothing to go on by this, but his terrific interest in it. But I find that people are terrific. It doesn't mean that you are experiencing it yourself, but you're experiencing things adjacent to it.
Yeah.
Which I think are actually very common.
Mm. Yeah.
He wrote lots of other good things. You can read them. Not everything he wrote is that great.
Yeah, they've all got great ideas, though. I do recommend, to be honest, the thing I recommend more than anything is like reading all the short stories.
Mm.
I think this, I like the short stories because you're kind of getting the ideas in very, very condensed form. Mm. And also, I think that maybe, yeah, I think there's a sort of a slight thing where the psychology of the characters sometimes isn't really sustained over the course of the novel, or it kind of, the arc of their psychology seems a little bit off.
I mean, you've read more than me. I suspect he can't actually do it.
Which in the short stories is less of a thing because people tend to just have one state and the story is about that, you know. And there are there's some really wonderful ones. What does any of it have to do with architecture? Not very much.
No. You can't make an architecture of epistemological anxiety.
Yeah.
It did make me think, at times I thought that his kind of machine regression thing was a little bit in the same universe as Darwin in the Machines, and that kind of the idea of machines having a kind of quasi life of their own
and of reproduction, evolutionary,
which we talked about. This is in, I think these are the all-time most unpopular About Buildings episodes of all time, the 19th century machine utopias episodes. But
yes, although there are some subtle differences, which is that his are organized entirely by the function for the product which is sold.
Yes. Yeah. The perception of the consumer.
I could imagine in the evolution, Darwin and the Machines, like something, you know, you can have kind of like things becoming something else. It's really the functional properties on which selection is being put, whereas it's more like, it's not, I don't know what the opposite of a telos is, but it's like the origin thing, the origin consumer idea, and then just iterations from the ideal is kind of how it seems in Ubik.
Mm.
Yeah.
Which in a way would be, again, that the thing that is true is the Stone Age technology wooden cup.
Yeah.
Mm.
That's real. And the marketing iterations of that are somehow insincere. Then it's really a story about human ideas rather than a Darwin in the Machines type, like.
I mean, also his vision of like Joe Chip's apartment from the perspective of the late 60s as this kind of sci-fi realm of total integration of coin-operated mod cons everywhere seems to me to be a kind of piss take on like modular plastic, like Rainer Banham, Archigram, kind of modular plastic.
It's also really focused on the kitchen, which makes me think of like both the tailorization of the kitchen post-war, time and motion studies, the American kitchen saving the idealized housewife so much time while baking a cake, or the Cold War like kitchens debates between Khrushchev and Nixon.
Yes.
In which gleaming products magnetize, bring down Homo Sovieticus with their chroming convenience.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a bit
like Smithson, Home of the Future.
Although, I mean, it was actually in the future, you know, Joe Colombo's total furnishing unit, this kind of...
Yeah.
This super sci-fi.
But I think by that point, they're doing it on purpose.
Yeah. It's quite knowing, but it is also really fun.
Yeah.
You know.
At that point, it's like deliberately science fiction and in fact, in a way, the kind of heroic science fiction of like the 30s is becoming a reference. Like, it's all slightly Flash Gordon.
Well, I think that we might be at the end.
That's
there.
Enough.
Yeah,
absolutely.
But thanks for that. Was just a little
palate cleanser.
Light moment.
You said what we're going to do next?
Well, no. Actually, no. Let's let it be a surprise.
This is episode 99.
Yeah.
Yep.
Next episode will be episode 100.
Yeah.
And we will be doing something big and nutritious to celebrate.
Yeah, but not anything particularly different from normal.
No.
Yeah. But yeah, that's a big milestone. It's been a lot of fun getting here and, you know, onward, I guess.
Yeah. Thanks to everyone who's been listening and in the many ways that people do supporting.
Yes.
The podcast. It quite literally wouldn't be happening without you in many ways. From, like, motivating us to do it by listening, which I think was the original thing that got carrying on.
Yeah.
To paying for its continued existence.
Yeah.
As well as encouraging us with kind words.
Interesting questions and you know, corrective answers.
We gladly
receive.
We have cunningly strange demiurges strewn factual inaccuracies, which only the chosen will be able to identify and somehow then unlock.
History has been falsified somehow. Yeah. How did that happen? If you're interested in any of that, all of the links to our kind of various allied platforms are on the website aboutbuildingsandcities.org. You can find all the links there.
Have very recently started wondering, channeling my geriatric Gen Z and starting to wander into the territory of TikTok. So if you're a listener and you're on TikTok, you can follow us, the usual handle, @about_buildings.
Gosh, we can add a link to that. What percentage of
the
audience do you think is on
your Mastodon account?
It's automated. It's I don't do anything on it. Yeah. But I've put a link back on it because
very much ahead of the curve there.
For people. It's been running for years. Thanks a lot for listening. See you on the next one.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.